It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's a two-parter. Part one, with all the attention being focused on Mitt Romney's tenure at Bain Capital, a private equity firm he founded, and the discussion of how many jobs it created or didn't create or destroyed, depending on whom you talk to, it seemed like a good idea to talk about what it is that private equity firms actually do. What happens in a leveraged buyout? Who wins? Who loses? Who collects a fee? And when did economic efficiency become the measuring stick for determining what's good for the country? Part two, both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama have accused each other of outsourcing American jobs overseas. Who's right? Who's wrong? Do they really disagree? After 9:30, we'll have a guest who says that both candidates actually approve of the practice, and we'll find out why he thinks so. First, private equity. My guest is Stephen Davidoff, Associate Professor of Law and Finance at Ohio State University's Moritz School of Law. He also writes as the Deal Professor for the New York Times Deal Book. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Good morning.
Bain Capital is a private equity firm. They're kind of being held up as the example of the industry. Let's start by talking about what private equity firms actually do.
Sure. So what a private equity firm does is it buys companies. The industry originated in the early 1980s, and what it does is it searches out public companies. It buys them using their own money, but mostly borrowed money in most circumstances. So you can think of it as akin to going out and buying houses. They buy a lot of houses using 30 to 40% of their own money and then borrow the rest. They take the companies private, then they own them, and the hope is that they'll grow and they'll make the companies better, increase revenue, increase profits, with the ultimate goal that they'll flip them and sell the companies at a later date at a significant profit. And it's been a very, very successful industry. They've made billions of dollars, if not more, from buying and selling companies over the years.
So the money is, some of the money comes internally from the people who own the private equity company. I mean, where does the money, some of it is borrowed from banks, some of it is, they raise it, what, from friends, from other companies, from investors?
Well, I wish I had friends like that. It's other people's money. So essentially what the private equity firms do is they raise billions of dollars, mostly from pension funds. So when you look at the teachers, the police officers of the United States, most of them are funding private equity deals. The private equity firms will raise a significant amount of money from these funds and endowments and other large, sophisticated investors, and they'll have that pot of money. And so when they go and buy a company, what they'll do is they'll use that money, and that's called the equity. And if we go back to our home analogy, that's the equity you put down on your house. That's your own money, right? But you borrow the rest. And so the private equity firm will put down 20 to 30% of this other people's money, and the rest it'll borrow. So there's yet more people, and that's from the banks. So often private equity firms are accused of putting too much leverage on the company, that they borrow too much money, because obviously when they borrow this money on the company, it needs to be taken paid back. And how is it paid back? It's paid back by the company itself that's been bought.
So, okay, when you say that they're investing their own money, I mean, it's a group of people are investing their money, and where does the private equity firm make money in this deal?
The private equity firm makes money everywhere. So what the private equity firm does is it charges something called a 2-in-20. So it takes 20% of the profits. So when it buys a company, it'll buy it for, let's say, $100 million. If it sells it for $200 million, that's $100 million in profit, and they'll take 20% of that. And then they also charge this 2% in admin fee. They charge fees for basically administering the transaction, advising the company. Most private equity firms now even have their own consultants. So what they'll do is they'll buy the company, and they'll actually charge the company not only for the debt, they'll make the company pay back the debt, but they'll actually charge it to provide consulting services and run the company.
There are circumstances under which the private equity company makes money whether or not the deal is successful.
Right. So if this all sounds complicated, it is. Okay. Essentially, remember, what's going on is private equity firms are putting up the money they've raised from these sophisticated investors, and they're borrowing money. Right? So how do private equity firms make money no matter what? Well, essentially what they do is as they go along, if they're buying, a mattress maker, okay, which has been a number of mattress makers have been bought by private equity firms, they'll buy the mattress maker, right? They'll borrow significant amounts of money that the mattress maker actually has to pay back, okay? And what they'll do is they'll buy it, and, you know, 2 or 3 years down the line, the company's worth more. And again, if we go back to the house analogy, your house is worth more, right? And prior to the financial crisis, when it was worth more, what you did is you refinanced it. You pulled out the equity. And that's often what private equity firms will do. They will refinance their mattress maker, borrow yet more money, and they'll pay that money to themselves. And that's all well and good, except 3 or 4 years later, the company may go bankrupt because it has too much debt on it. Okay,
well, what's the difference between this and a pyramid scheme then?
This is not a pyramid scheme.
Well, but at the end of the day, this debt is still out there, and somebody has to pay it. Maybe the analogy is this is a game of musical chairs. Or hot potato, and woe unto you if you're the person who ends up holding all the debt at the end, and who gets stuck with somebody gets stuck with the tab at some point.
Right. Well, so in the majority of circumstances, private equity deals actually work out. They're capitalists. I mean, they come in, they're going to restructure the company, they're going to make changes. People may lose jobs. Okay, and so that can be very unpopular, to say the least, I think is the first thing. The second thing is you asked who ends up holding the potato. Well, it's the banks, the people who lend the money. If the loan doesn't work out, just like a loan on a house doesn't work out, these are the people who are left with the debt. So the people holding the potato are the banks and the people who otherwise lend money to private equity. And the question is, why do they lend it to them? They presumably do because they think it's a good investment at the time. Sometimes it's not.
Okay, but there are some tax advantages to having this debt too, aren't there?
Oh, yes. I mean, there are huge subsidies to private equity firms through the tax code. And the main one is debt is deductible. So If I am a company and I have $100 million worth of profits, I'm just going to pay taxes on that, and that's all well and good. But if I can deduct from those profits and not pay taxes on any interest payments I have on my debt, and that gives a significant subsidy to private equity and allows them to take on more leverage, take on more debt, and make more money. That's the first and probably the biggest. The second way that private equity takes advantage of the tax code is something called carried interest. So remember how we said private equity charges that 20% and gets 20% of the profits? So when you or I earn money, we pay income tax on it, right? It goes up to 28%. It can be even higher if you make more money. Private equity is able to structure it as something called carried interest, which gets capital gains treatment. And so the 20% profits that private equity makes is treated as capital gains and only taxed at a 15% rate. What that means in plain English is that most of private equity's profits are taxed at only 15% instead of the much higher income tax rate.
What about the criticism of the leveraged buyout as having a negative effect on companies and their workers?
Sure. So So the problem that's often raised is these companies have much more debt than they did before they were bought, okay? And that debt needs to be repaid. What the accusation made is that to repay this debt, companies will restructure, fire workers, won't have enough to invest. They're basically a slave to their debt instead of growing healthy companies. Now,
right.
That's the accusation. It's certainly the case that some of these companies go bankrupt because of this debt. The question is, do they create jobs, these companies? Do they still hire as they did before? And there haven't been a lot of studies. Private equity is a pretty secretive organization. But those that are out there find that in general, doesn't mean in every case, in general, private equity firms actually create jobs at the companies that they own.
Now, do they create them where?
They create them by growing the companies. They create them by restructuring the companies, operating them more efficiently, creating new products, having better management. Now, obviously, that's a generality. And in certain cases, private equity firms have put too much debt on companies and pushed them into bankruptcy.
Let's see. Let's get some calls in here because we're going to kind of shift gears at 9:30 and look at this from a different perspective. So I'd like to make sure we get folks in who want to talk about this topic. So let's go to Andy in Lake Geneva first, and then maybe we'll take a break and come back with more calls. Andy, hang on just 1 second. I want to give the phone number for everybody else, 800-486-8655. If you want to talk about private equity and leveraged buyouts, now is the chance to do that. 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. Okay, Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, John, I've been involved in leveraged buyouts over the years through our private equity firm. And what your commentator needs to bring out, or what I'd like to bring out, to your point about, well, if it's re-leveraged, it can go bankrupt. The reality is that private equity firms initially look at companies that have significant market share or, in fact, can grow into significant market share, have consistent cash flows, and don't have a lot of future capital expenditures. So the net effect is you'll see many of these companies are companies that effectively can, unless they overpay and over-leverage. And if a private equity firm overpays or over-leverage, I can guarantee you their equity will be wiped out. Now, they get a lot of fees around the side and so on, but the reality is that CARE has, like anything, if you overpay for a house and you over-leverage it, like what happened in the housing crisis, the same basic effect. But most of the time, they're looking at companies that effectively have already significant market share, or more importantly, can be grown into significant market share. And that's where your commentator or your guest there said they can accrete or they can add basically jobs by doing a variety of things that essentially enhance the company's fundamental strength and reduce its weaknesses.
So I agree with that. I mean, I think everyone... as the commentator here, I think everyone's in this game to make money. Private equity firms don't make money generally if companies go bankrupt, although they can. And they're looking for companies that can service this debt. I think that what the caller said is all basically true.
All right, we'll come back with more in just a moment. We're talking about private equity and companies, what they do, how they work. Wondering what questions you have for our guests. Just a reminder that after 9:30, we'll be taking a look at the offshoring of jobs, because that's something that private equity firms have been accused of doing. We'll take a look at how that works and who's actually offshoring jobs and whether or not it's inevitable given the global economy. That's a topic we'll start up after 9:30 this morning. So right now, if you want to talk about private equity and leveraged buyouts, this is the time to do it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. Or you can leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show page on Facebook, and we'll share it here on the air. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:22. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Here's what's going on later on today on the Ideas Network. As America slowly pulls itself out of a long recession, much of the talk has been about jobs. But what about the rebuilding of American wealth and prosperity? Ben Marins and his guests discuss the state of American wealth and what ideas can be put in place to help Americans save more and build their assets. That's after 3 today on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about private equity and leveraged buyouts, at least for the next 10 minutes or so. My guest is Stephen Davidoff, Associate Professor of Law and Finance at Ohio State University's Moritz School of Law. He also writes as the Deal Professor for the New York Times Deal Book. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to John in Madison next. John, good morning.
Morning, guys. Hey, I'm a corporate lawyer who kind of does this sort of work. And just to put it in context, there's nothing inherently good or bad about private equity. It's, you need to think of it as part of a life cycle of a business. So you have a guy, maybe he's a building contractor, figures out how to put holes in walls so that you don't have to cut it by a hacksaw and develops this little device to do that. He gets his friend out of his garage to design it, a tool and die maker. They have a little business. They sell it to the local guys. Then the venture capitalists come in because they say, well, look, we need to hire some engineers. We've got some other good ideas. So the venture capitalists come in. It's very risky money. That's why they call it venture capital. And they hire a couple of engineers, maybe have some contacts at some Mark firms or Lowe's or something like that that picks it up. Well, this company gets to be a pretty sized company, let's say 25 or 100 annual revenues. And the inventors, they're done. You know, they've taken 20 years to build this, don't want to pass it on to their family, not big enough to go public yet. Then you have the private equity guy come in. They will buy out more mature, middle-sized businesses often. They have the capital to do so, and perhaps they international ties that can bring this new gadget, whatever, to China, to other developing countries who need those sorts of things. At some point, the private equity guys will sell out and maybe take the company public. In back of the private equity guys are the banks. And this isn't a sort of hedge fund, you know, trades gone bad type banks. These are banks lending against assets, getting in interest, and paying out their shareholders, you, me, pension funds, interest on their blue chip merchant banking. So it's not inherently good or bad. It's just part of a life cycle. Sometimes they make good investments. Sometimes they make bad investments. Sometimes when a private equity firm comes in, they say, look, you know, having all of these extra people in a business division that is not profitable, we need to jettison that. We need to lay those people off or fire them. And it's awful. It's terrible. But to do that, they then free up money to invest in more profitable divisions or product lines. It can be messy. The people who get pinched hard. There should be social safety nets for that. But all in all, it really is a positive engine for growth. I just thought I'd give that kind of perspective to it. Most of the middle market business owners that I've worked with are great guys, great women, great families. It's just a way for them to exit out of their company and pass it on to, I guess, the next larger level of professional management.
Professor?
I think that's right. I mean, essentially, as part of our capitalist system, there are winners and losers. And what private equity does is it comes in and it buys what are presumably growing businesses or inefficient businesses and makes them more efficient. We saw that in the 80s. They were voracious buyers of which were frankly inefficient companies. They bought them, they cleaned them up, they sold them.
Hang on a second. Okay, but these were going back to the 80s because there were probably more incidences of companies basically just being closed. And for example, some small furniture maker in New England gets bought out and the furniture brand stays, but the furniture starts getting made someplace where they can make it a lot cheaper. And all those people who worked for this company and lived in this community wherever they were are now out of work. It's the underlying assumption to all of this, and what bothers some people, and as I've been reading about this, the underlying assumption in all of this is that economic efficiency is the highest good for society. And there are some people who are questioning and who have questioned whether or not that's true or even a really good idea. I mean, what we've heard and what you've been talking about and what our callers have been talking about so far is, okay, well, some of these companies aren't performing as well as they should, and they're not efficient, and so we're going to come in and clean this up, and we're going to make this company more efficient. Okay, well, you know, who does that efficiency benefit? At the end of the day, if you, let's take a small community that's got a paper mill. Maybe the paper mill is a little bit older. It's still profitable, but it's not as profitable as, say, a new paper mill someplace else where labor costs might be a little bit less. And so we close that old paper mill, and we take those jobs and we put them somewhere else. Okay, well, who benefited from that? Certainly not that community where maybe 150 people lost jobs that were good jobs that supported families and so forth. But it was more efficient to move those jobs someplace else. Isn't there a place to ask the question, is economic efficiency the most important thing that we have to think about in terms of our society here in either the United States of America or the world? Is everything supposed to be sacrificed on that altar?
Well, I think, let's be clear, that's not a question just for private equity. That's a question for every big corporation in America.
Absolutely right.
It's a good question to ask. But we live in a capitalistic society, and these are the choices we make. If we as a society want to hold other values or other values up, that's certainly a choice we can make. But in terms of this is a private equity issue, I think this is a societal issue. Now, The argument that people would say back to you is what we're doing is we're making, yes, these people will be harmed, but remember back 100 years ago, most Americans were farmers, right? And we had massive technological change and people lost their jobs. And what happened is we allocated those resources more efficiently, which is a very cold and hard sounding way to put it. Economically, we all benefited because of that, right? We would probably prefer to be where we are now than being on the farm, or at least we have that choice. And the question, though, is how we help the people who are displaced, how we look after them, and how we help them transition. But these are big choices for society that I think affect more than just private equity. I think they're decisions that every corporation faces these days, and every town faces.
Let's get a call in quickly before we add another guest. Eric in Milwaukee, you're up. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for the topic. It's very dynamic. Appreciate it. My first question is if the professor could give a very quick, brief summary of the history of this manner of doing business. He's referenced the 80s and so forth. So I'm wondering, were there changes in Congress in the earlier 80s or 70s or what have you that then allowed this manner of private equity firms to become so popular way of doing business? And then second, maybe I missed it, but I didn't hear a disincentive for a private equity firm merely to buy a company and slash and burn, sell off the assets, and then if it's bankrupt, I mean, if you're still losing money, I'm not quite hearing a disincentive for just to go in, borrow, slash and burn, sell off the assets, and then, you know, write off the interest. So if I missed it, if you could go over that, that would be appreciated, and I'll take my answer off the phone.
Sure. So to take the first question, the reason why private equity arose in the 1980s was essentially the debt markets developed enough to be able to lend them significant amounts of money, encouraged by a tax deduction given by Congress for that debt that had previously been unavailable. And the second thing that sort of spurred the private equity market was U.S. companies at the time were not as efficient. They had been protected in their domestic markets. The Japanese were just starting to come over. There were a lot of very inefficient companies, and It was not unusual for private equity firms to buy these companies and actually break them up and sell them, what was alluded to before. Today, the disincentive from that is that companies are much more efficient. You don't have they've already done the restructurings that they need to do. So you don't see private equity firms coming in today to break up a company or to otherwise liquidate it. What they're doing is they're buying operating companies and operating them more efficiently. And I think just the second question is what's their disincentive? I mean, they generally lose money when a company goes bankrupt. They also lose reputational capital. No one likes to go to their investors and say that a company's been bankrupt. They certainly have ways to make sure that they have a profit, but their incentive is to not go into bankruptcy in most cases. But it's a capitalistic system. They're going to operate on an efficient basis for good or for bad.
Eric, thanks. Thanks for that call. What I understand from reading some articles in preparation for this is that it's getting a little tougher for private equity firms to find banks to finance their operations, and so they're having to use more and more and more of their own money and investor money to make these buys, and that's maybe tempering this a little bit. Would you agree with that observation?
Yeah, it's not the business it used to be. They're not making as much money. It's harder for them to find companies. Banks lost a lot of money in the financial crisis. They don't have as much money to lend. So they're just not making the money they used to. And that's probably going to be something we're going to see for the foreseeable future. So
right.
Mitt Romney got out at the right time.
Well, you know, that's really the key to business success is knowing when to get out, isn't it?
Right. It's better to be lucky than smart.
That's one of my college professors always told me it's better to be lucky than good. But I think lucky than smart might deal with that, too.
Or perhaps he timed it well. Maybe he was smart.
Well, like humor, timing is everything. I know that you need to leave us. I hope you can stick around for just a moment. We're having trouble getting our next guest on the phone, and we've got some more callers who want to ask questions here. Let's take Bud in Waukesha next. Bud, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point real quickly. I did a lot of legal work on both sides, investor side and fundraisers. When a firm like Bain Capital goes into business, what they do is form limited partnerships of limited lifespan. When Americans are looking for long-term economic planning and vision, venture capital is not the place to go. Those folks have to make big bucks fast. They will take over a firm that has a good idea. Their target will be to sell it fast to another buyer or go to an IPO as soon as possible. In addition to the tax subsidies they get from on their own personal incomes as general partners in the partnership, and their disproportionate 20%, they can only get that 20% if they have made big bucks on prior funds. Starting up a fund is not easy. You get an easier negotiation if you can point to 5 or 6 deals over a period of years that have been big winners. 10 years is the lifespan. They're not in business to buy the mom-and-pop grocery store and benefit the neighborhood for the next 50 years. They're in business to turn the property. They're like house slippers. They want to get in, make a big profit as soon as possible, get out, get more investors like the State of Wisconsin Investment Board in with their multi-millions of dollars to be invested. It's a very profitable small sector of any major investor's portfolio, alternative private equity, and it's understood. A couple home runs pay everybody off. They're losers, they're winners, a few winners, but the winners are winners because they can be flipped fast. There's no long-term commitment to social benefit, period. It is all what goes on the books, what can be put into the next offering memorandum to attract the next crew of investors for fund 2, 3, 4, 5 down the road. 10 years is about it, and they're starting to do their marketing 7 years out, even before the current fund is done. And those payouts that Romney is due may come from earlier funds. Entirely understandable. They're still in operation until they liquidate and close down. That's just my point from the inside, helping fundraisers raise the funds and investors try to figure out which investments are worth making. It's not necessarily bad or good, but it's fast, short term.
Yeah. So I think two things. One is to answer your question, and the second is just to remind your listeners again that the State of Wisconsin Investment Board, the pension funds of your public employees, are heavily invested in private equity. And when private equity earns a return, that goes to public employees. I mean, it's ironic if you're sort of criticizing private equity for destroying jobs or otherwise acting inappropriate for society, that they are funded by, you know, the public workers of America in large part. And if they do make that money flows back to those public workers. As we know, the pensions are in trouble and they're looking for a return. They're looking to private equity for that. I think the second thing on the short-term horizon, private equity funds do have a 10-year horizon, and they do look to make money as quick as possible, just like any business today. They can be criticized for short-termism. They generally hold their investments, KKR, the larger ones, you know, 6 years, to 6 to 8 years. They do hold them longer than the lifespan of the funds, which again are 10 years. But they will look to cash out as soon as they can and make as much money, just like any business. So I sort of agree with the caller.
How do they determine the selling price of a company? Is there a way to set the market price for a company? Is there some multiplier? Or I know, for example, because I'm in the radio business and have been for about 40 years, I know that in purchasing radio stations, the benchmark used to be, I think it was 2.5 times gross revenue per year. Is there a number that they use to determine what the purchase price of a company should be and what's a good deal and what isn't?
Right. So generally, and one of the other callers alluded to this, they're looking for cash flows. Essentially, they can only pay as much as they need to earn their return, right? They need to earn a return for their investors and pay down their debt. So that's the maximum price they can pay. And to do that, they're looking for companies that spin off a lot of cash. Now, in terms of the price they pay, they're going to look for that, but they're also going to look for metrics. Again, it's how do you price a house, right? You look at what other houses are selling for. You look at comparables. You look at is it a hot market? And generally, sometimes you have what we call, you know, 6 to 8 times EBITDA. What's the premium for other companies being sold? So there are common metrics in the market. But the key is they need to get enough cash to pay their debt.
All right. Let's see. Let's go to George in La Crosse next. George, go ahead.
Hello. My experience was a leveraged buyout in 1990. We had one LBO firm was going to buy the company and bust it up and break it up. A second LBO firm came to the management of the company and said, you want to join us in being investors in a leveraged buyout whereby we will keep the company together. We will try to make it more efficient. We will grow the company. We will invest in the company and so forth. So the management, about 100 management people invested in the company as part of the equity. 7 years later, we emerged successful paying down our debt to a reasonable level, went with an initial public offering, and became a public company again with the management and the 100 employees making significant gains and the leveraged buyout firm making significant gains, and the stock price of the company at the time of the initial public offering provided for shareholders for the future to grow, and the company became quite successful and kept growing. Yes, we did restructure the company in the sense that we looked at product lines or certain non-core businesses and sold those off to other people and then retained the core business of the company. And yes, we restructured layers of middle management because we had seven layers of management between the top guy and the floor of the factory, and we reduced that to 4 layers and became much more efficient and allow us to grow and be successful. Without that, the company would have slowly gone into bankruptcy.
Professor, well, a big success story there.
Well, first of all, I'm impressed by how many people in the private equity industry listen to your show. It seems terrific. I think second, I don't know if this occurred in Wisconsin earlier last year. Renaissance Learning, which was a public company incorporated in Wisconsin, had agreed to be taken over by a private equity firm, Permira. And under Wisconsin, under your corporate laws, you've actually said that companies in deciding whether to sell themselves can consider community factors. So most companies are incorporated in Delaware. In Delaware, when they sell themselves, they have to get the highest price reasonably available. It doesn't matter what the acquirer wants to do with the company. Wisconsin, it's different. They can consider community factors, the employees, et cetera. And Renaissance had agreed to sell itself to a private equity firm when another bidder, a strategic company, came along and said, we'll pay more. And the company was controlled by a family, the Pauls, and they said, no, we're not going to do that, okay? We're in Wisconsin. We can take account community factors. This private equity firm, Permira, has promised to keep jobs in Wisconsin, people in Wisconsin. The strategic firm is not going to do that. And so we're going to take less money to keep jobs in Wisconsin and keep this company together. And I tell that story because I think it cuts both ways. Strategic buyers, companies can look to rationalize, can look to downsize, can look to cut companies. Your caller mentioned they did it themselves, right? Private equity firms can do the same. But there's money to be made in keeping your employees happy and keeping the community happy. And probably Permira realized that. And so it's you can't just generalize is the point.
All right. Well, Professor, thank you for sticking with us here this morning and for an educational hour so far. We have to let you go. We're going to change our gears just a little bit here, but I appreciate your being with us and answering all those questions.
Thank you.
The Stephen Davidoff, Associate Professor of Law and Finance at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, and he also writes as the Deal Professor for the New York Times Deal Book. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about outsourcing and offshoring of jobs and what are the differences between President Obama and Mitt Romney. The answer might be interesting. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 9:45. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. World markets took a beating Monday, and the euro slid to a two-year low against the dollar. Amid the dizzying statistics, Walter Russell Mead argues that the crisis rises beyond economics. Politically, he says, Turkey, Asia, NATO, the U.S., pretty much everyone is a loser. The fallout from the euro crisis, plus Michel Flournoy on the president's foreign policy. That's coming up on Talk of the Nation after 1 o'clock today on the Ideas Network. Well, part of the political discussion about Bain Capital has centered on offshoring jobs. President Obama's campaign has focused on this as an issue, attempting to paint Mitt Romney as someone who sends American jobs overseas. In response, the Romney campaign has dubbed President Obama outsourcer-in-chief for investing government funds in energy companies that hired workers abroad. Well, for the rest of this hour, we're going to turn our attention to the issue of offshoring jobs. And joining me is Adam Serwer, reporter for the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine. Adam Serwer, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn program.
Thanks for having me.
You recently wrote an article for Mother Jones Magazine with the headline, Romney and Obama Don't Always Disagree About Outsourcing. Your article suggests that despite all the bickering on the issue, the two candidates for president aren't all that far apart. What do you mean by that?
Well, they're apart on policy in terms of how they deal with outsourcing, but they're not really apart on the inevitability of outsourcing, the basic economics of outsourcing. Both candidates sort of understand or sort of believe that outsourcing is an inevitability in a global economy and that it's going to happen. The problem is that outsourcing isn't very popular, and so neither one of them wants to actually defend it. So you've got Romney, who's saying, you know, I didn't work at Bain while it was outsourcing jobs, but he hasn't said I would have done something differently or I wouldn't have outsourced. And you have Obama who's saying, look, Romney outsourced all these jobs, but fundamentally Obama's proposed policies wouldn't end outsourcing. It wouldn't outlaw outsourcing. They might disincentivize it a little bit, but it's not like the president thinks that there's much that can be done about the fact that for some people it's going to be cheaper to do business elsewhere.
Well, under current policy, tax policy, for example, there's actually some benefit to companies that send jobs overseas. A lot of people have kind of scratched their heads at that. Why are we paying companies to send our jobs elsewhere?
Well, I mean, this is the Obama campaign's argument, right? And what they've said, and I talked to an economist who used to work in Biden's office, and he said, you know, the big difference between the Romney campaign and the Obama campaign is that the Obama campaign, you know, while Obama might recognize outsourcing as an inevitability, they're willing, they don't think it should be incentivized. We shouldn't be encouraging companies to move jobs overseas. And so, that's really where the argument takes place, is how you deal with outsourcing. On the other, you know, the Obama campaign could argue that they support a more robust safety net that will aid workers while they're when it comes to stuff like healthcare, when they're in between jobs, while the Romney campaign supports a much more pared down social safety net because they've endorsed the Paul Ryan's plan. But as far as the economics goes, they're pretty much on the same page, which is why they're not arguing about that at all.
Let's go to the phones and get some calls in here, since we're already starting to run a little short of time on this topic. We'll go to Monroe and hear from Laverne first. Laverne, go ahead.
Hello, John. Great program. Hello, Adam.
Hi, how are you doing?
I agree with President Obama 100% because they are exporting jobs abroad, and they're keeping the profit offshore so they don't have to pay taxes. Why not, with a growing debt, like Obama said, tax the hedge fund dealers? Then you know where the money's hit out at.
I think you're right. I mean, that's where the campaigns really do differ a whole lot, is on taxes and whose ox gets gored. And if you think, you know, we should be getting more of our tax revenue from the wealthy, then, I mean, you're probably going to agree with the Obama campaign. If, on the other hand, you think the wealthy are job creators and their taxes are too high and that's why the economy is bad, then you probably support Mitt Romney.
All right, Laverne, thanks for the call. A number of people you cited in your article talk about the idea that, well, globalization of the economy makes outsourcing and offshoring pretty much inevitable. It's the way, and our professor couldn't stay with us, but I'm sure he would have said, listen, this is just how capitalism works. Jobs go where employers can find the best cost-benefit ratio. It's been suggested that there actually are benefits to the American economy from this practice. Do you agree with that?
From a net economic perspective, it makes goods cheaper. I mean, when it's cheaper to make something, then it's cheaper to, it turns out to be cheaper to buy it. So in terms of, for consumers, there's a benefit. From the group of workers who would benefit from having those jobs here, those people are certainly hurt by it. But the general consensus of economists is that on balance, it does more good than bad.
800-486-8655, a chance for you to get in with a quick phone call if you call right now. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave a comment on Facebook. The Kathleen Dunn Show has a Facebook page. You can leave your comment or question there, and we'll share it with the listeners. We're talking about offshoring or outsourcing of jobs overseas and how the two presidential candidates stand on this. My guest, who has written an article about this for Mother Jones Magazine, says basically, they're not that far apart on the general concept of jobs moving, and it's seen as kind of an inevitability of the globalization of the economy. And where they do differ is on what American policy should actually be. So what's your sense, Adam, of how the voters are seeing this issue? We get a lot of demagoguing on both sides of this particular issue, and it's pretty easy to do, frankly. What's your sense of how the voters actually see this?
Well, I think you can see you can sort of see, like, the campaigns themselves do a lot of polling on stuff like this, and they tailor their attack lines based on that kind on what they think voters think. And I think it's very clear from the way that Romney and Obama are talking about this that outsourcing is unpopular. People don't like outsourcing. They don't want to hear politicians defend outsourcing. So Romney has not defended outsourcing, and Obama has not implied that he thinks, you know, this is the kind of thing that's going to happen, and we just have to learn how to deal with it. It's not particularly popular, and so the result is that we're having this argument about when Mitt Romney was at Bain, even though it's not really exactly that relevant, since Romney hasn't said he'd do anything differently. And as Mother Jones has reported, he's certainly, his company invested in firms that outsourced even prior to his having left to run the Olympics in 1999.
Let's take a quick call here from Willem in Colfax. Willem, good morning.
Good morning. I think the problem is how to tie all this into some sort of, like, nationalism, like some nation, like the United States, because money is its own. Money has no boundaries. It has no nation. As long as profit is the main goal, and that they've actually had letters from people like Ron Johnson, other people who tried to tie profit into morality, I think that as long as that's the case, as long as making money is the ultimate goal, then it has no nation, it has no loyalty, it has no patriotism, it certainly has no morals. And I think maybe we should change that. Instead of in God we trust, in money we trust, because that seems to be the ultimate, our ultimate religion is making money is the ultimate goal, no matter, you know, whether it costs jobs, whether, as long as it makes money, it's all right.
Adam?
Well, I mean, I think that's sort of the idea behind capitalism, right? As people, we expect businesses to try and make money and do everything they can to make money, but that's sort of why you need a government to regulate and make sure that, you know, businesses aren't doing things that are unscrupulous or otherwise, you know, taking actions that endanger other people, the way that we saw with the economic crisis, 4 years ago.
Well, I mean, this is kind of like what we were talking with the professor with about private equity. It's not good or bad. It's the system that we have.
Right.
Okay. Let's take one more call. Karen in Green Bay. Karen, good
Hello.
Morning. Yeah, go ahead.
Hello. Okay, one of my points is that I think what's really hard for people to see in the United States is that when the companies do offshore for lower labor prices and things like that, the ones who do benefit actually are the highest earners, you know, CEOs and people like that in the companies who make, you know, I saw something yesterday with Caterpillar's CEO making $17 million, and they're cutting the wages of the Caterpillar workers. That's what's hard to see, where we have people in the United States which shouldn't be, that are homeless, and I work with these families every day, homeless, they don't have enough to eat, they don't have health care, children whose teeth are rotting out. So we need more government regulation. You know, capitalism, fine, but we need more government regulation to be a human country or humane country, because we're not anymore, which is very sad. And our forefathers, there are several forefathers who did warn us of happening with capitalism.
Karen, thanks for the call. Adam, comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think that's sort of the argument that the Obama campaign is making, right? I mean, it's fine, you know, businesses will make money, but it's important to have a government that does things that, you know, that invests, that builds roads, that makes sure people have health care, and that, you know, people have unemployment insurance when they, when they're laid off, or that they have money in their old age with Social Security. I mean, that's sort of what this argument is about at base. And so it's almost a little weird that we've gotten into this argument about outsourcing, since the real argument is about, at least it seems to be, about the size of the American welfare state and how much a government should help people and how much it should leave them on their own.
So let's fast forward. The election is over and somebody got elected. How do you see either one of these two candidates playing this issue out during their either the next term for President Obama or a first term for a President Romney? Where do you see them going on this issue Or are they just going to not just talk about it in the campaign and then not do anything? Is this not going to be a policy question that anybody wants to touch?
Well, look, I think it. Whenever you're talking about voting for a presidential candidate, I think people worry too much about the candidate as a person and less about, I mean, the candidate is an avatar of their party, and they're going to pursue the policies of their party, and it matters a lot less than we think who the individual person is. I will say that, you know, there's not, as far as what the candidates have proposed, there's not much that they can do without Congress. They need Congress to pass a law in order to say, you know, close tax loopholes for a company or tax incentives for companies that want to move their operations overseas. I mean, that's Obama can't change that without an act of Congress. So okay. I think the truth is that these candidates are going to do what they say they're going to do, or they're going to try to do that. But whether or not they actually do it depends a lot on what Congress looks like.
Okay. And that's where we're going to have to leave it, Adam. Thanks so much for joining us this
morning. Thanks for having me.
Adam Serwer, a reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine. His article was the genesis of this part of the discussion. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for working to get this hour of programming on the air. Thanks to you for listening, calling in, and so forth, and appreciate it. We'll be back with more after the news. We're going to talk about what's going on with the penalties assessed to Penn State University's football program. I'm John Munson. In for Kathleen Dunn, you're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR.